Welcome to episode 118 of the Blooms of Barnacles podcast, where we talk about all things relating to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Dermot.
And I'm Kelly. How are you, Dermot?
Pretty good.
Great. Are you excited to talk about some Irish history?
Well, it's a famously happy subject. Laughs and giggles all the way. So yeah.
Yep. Well, Dermot and I have been listening to a lot of Behind the Bastards podcasts lately, which is all about history's worst people. Mm. And so I'm excited that we get to talk about an Irish bastard today. So I'll leave that as a little teaser. We are a blog as well as a podcast, and I've been very productive lately. I kind of had three blog posts come out in quick succession, and we had one that we didn't really promote on the podcast. It is entitled John Howard Parnell. So I want to take a little bit of time to talk about that right now. Dermot, what is my blog post entitled John Howard Parnell about?
The less known older brother of Charles Stuart Parnell of Home Rule fame.
Yes, and he does appear in Ulysses very briefly, but as you might or might not know, we love an obscure Ulysses character. So I did some research into who he was as a person, what he did, and is he as much of a lazy, good-for-nothing as he seems in Ulysses?
Listeners in the Atlanta, Georgia region will be interested to know there's a connection.
Not Atlanta. I would say Alabama.
Alabama.
The Alabama-Georgia border.
But he is involved in peaches, and I was thinking the Peachtree Street in Atlanta.
Well, he's erroneously credited with something related to peach cultivation.
Yeah.
And if erroneous peach cultivation doesn't excite you, maybe Dermot's artwork will. Can you tell us about the artwork you did for this blog post?
Yeah, he was described as melancholically playing chess in a coffee shop, having bad cakes. So I have him playing chess against the ghost of his brother.
Okay.
If you notice carefully, Charles Stuart Parnell's ghost fingers can't move the pieces because he's a ghost.
Because he's a ghost. All right. If somebody would like to read my blog post about not just John Howard Parnell, but several other Parnell siblings who are all very interesting, and see Dermot's artwork, where can they do that?
At our site, bloomsandbarnacles.com.
That's right. You'll find links to it on all of our socials in the usual places and our website as well. So check that out. It ended up being way more interesting than I thought it would be. We got a few shout outs. First of all, thank you so much to everyone who's donated to our podcast. We really do appreciate your donations, and they definitely keep the ring light on. If you'd like to be amongst this exalted elite, you can go to our website,
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll find a link that says donate, and you can either make a one-time donation to our PayPal, or if you'd like to subscribe monthly, you can find us at patreon.com/barnaclecast. And if you are so gracious as to be a recurring donor on Patreon, you get early access to all our episodes, as well as a video version and a monthly bonus episode. Dermot, do you want to tell them a little bit about September's bonus episode?
I've already forgotten because we've done about four in a row.
Okay. I had the wonderful opportunity to interview scholar Elizabeth O'Connor, who wrote a really interesting article a few years back about another minor Ulysses character by the name of Lizzie Twigg.
The badly done by lady poet.
That's right. So Elizabeth literally wrote the book, well, journal article about Lizzie Twigg. And it was really interesting to talk to her. We had some fun getting into the psyche of James Joyce and also just about the literary landscape of 1904. Go over to patreon.com/barnaclecast and check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it. If you'd like to support us in a non-monetary fashion, please leave a review on your podcast app of choice or tell a friend who you think might enjoy our podcast as well. And finally, if you want to keep up with everything we do, please sign up for our free newsletter at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Right? It's free to do so, and you'll get links to all of our shows and blog posts at the top of each month. You can also follow us on all the usual social medias. Let's get into it then. We are currently working our way through Aeolus, which is Ulysses' seventh episode, and we're on page 126 today in my edition, which is the 1990 Vintage International Edition. Dermot, do you remember what we talked about last time?
No.
Okay. We talked about Dan Dawson. Does that name jog your memory?
No.
Does the word effulgent mean anything to you?
Effulgent, the poet, the awful poetry.
Yes.
He's a bad poet.
He's not a poet at all.
It should be a poet because it's so
awful. He was actually an orator because rhetoric and oratory are the art and technique of this episode.
It was prose that was so purple, it was almost poetic, but it was bad poetry.
Yes. And we made fun of his use of the word effulgence a bit, though it did not appear in last week's text. Mm-hmm. It does appear in today's. We also called him Doughy Daw or Doughy Dan, and this is which also did not appear in the previous episode, but does appear in this one. So I'm starting to think maybe I should have just thrown this section into that episode as well, but I didn't. And sometimes it's the imperfections in life that make it all the more beautiful. So please ponder that as Dermot reads our first section today. So you're going to go from Roman numeral 3.
Roman numeral 3.
Have to read the Roman numeral.
His native Doric. The moon, Professor McHugh said. He forgot Hamlet. That mantles the vista far and wide, and wait till the glowing orb of the moon shine forth to irradiate her silver effulgence. Oh, Mr. Daedalus cried, giving vent to a hopeless groan. Shite and onions! That'll do, Ned. Life is too short. He took off his silk hat and, blowing out impatiently his bushy moustache, Welch combed his hair with raking fingers. Ned Lambert tossed the newspaper aside, chuckling with delight. An instant after, a hoarse bark of laughter burst over Professor McHugh's unshaven black spectacle face. Doughy Daw, he cried.
Okay, what do you think?
So it's the last bit where they're like, this is the worst of the part where he says effulgence.
That's about it. Is there anything else you think?
So what's Welsh combed?
This.
That using your fingers?
Yeah, a finger.
Is that
finger
a Welsh comb? Is that racist? Is that
yes,
a racist
it's term? Racist against Welsh people.
Welsh people are so poor, they can't afford to use their fingers.
They're so rustic, shall we say, that they don't have combs.
Okay.
I always call it finger combing because I'm
not a Welsh
hater. Yeah. I rather like the Welsh. So
yeah, the Welsh are all right. You used to get Welsh television as kids growing up, so we got very familiar with the sound of the Welsh language.
Yeah.
S4C and HTV and all that.
All right. I like the phrase shite and onions. Mm-hmm. I know reading this aloud with people, that always gets a reaction.
Yeah, no, I've heard that actually used in
the
wild.
Really?
Yeah.
Who might use shite and onions?
People in my hometown, Arklow, I've heard people say it. Like, I think one of my cousins, maybe they picked it up from Ulysses, but I've heard people say shite and onions. Yeah.
Wow.
And as well as you sick in my shite, as another
okay,
one.
Okay, yes, you've said that a lot to me. Not to me personally, but that's a phrase that you enjoy.
Yeah.
All right. Dermot can be quite colorful and folksy when he lets his guard down a little bit.
Yes. And I take my little professor glasses off and roll up my sleeves.
All right. I don't have a whole lot to say about this, but I have a whole lot to say about the next headline section, which is going to be the rest of this episode. That's how much I have to say about it. So.
Okay. What Wetherup said. All very fine to jeer at it now in cold print, but it does go down like hot cake, that stuff. He was in the bakery line too, wasn't he? Why do they call him Doughy Daw? Feathered his nest with anyhow. Daughter engaged that chap in the Inland Revenue Office with the motor. Hook that nicely. Entertainments. Open house. Big blowout. Wetherup always said that. Get a grip of them by the stomach. The inner door was opened violently and a scarlet beaked face, crested by a comb of feathery hair, thrust itself in. The bold blue eyes stared about them and the harsh voice asked, What is it? And here comes the sham squire himself, Professor McHugh said grandly. Get on out that, you bloody old pedagogue, the editor said in recognition. Come, Ned, Mr. Dedalus said, putting on his hat. I must get a drink after that. Drink, the editor cried. No drink, sir, before mass. Quite right, too, Mr. Dedalus said, going out. Come on, Ned. Ned Lambert sidled down from the table. The editor's blue eyes roved towards Mr. Bloom's face, shadowed by a smile. Will you join us, Miles? Ned Lambert asked.
All right, so what's your impression of this section?
So they're just tying up the whole effulgence issue, I think. Are they talking, that first paragraph, trying to parse like who they're, Doughy Daw, that's person.
That's Dan Dawson.
Dan Dawson, the
Mr.
bad
Mr. Effulgence
writer.
Himself.
They say he feathered his nest well anyhow. I'm taking like he's got plenty of money.
Yeah.
So he's a shite writer,
but
he's got money, don't they all? Mm-hmm. Daughter engaged that chap in the Inland Revenue Office with the motor. Oh, a car. So someone has a car in 1904.
Yes, so his daughter married well. Mm. You know, he's high status.
Yeah, hook that nicely. All right. Entertainment. So entertainment says mm-hmm. Doey Daw has parties, open house, big blowouts, people, you know, very, sounds like he's very socially, like, generous, mm-hmm. maybe. Weatherwell said that, get a grip of them by the stomach. So abusing people's stomachs, is it to, like, make connections? Is that what he's implying?
I think so. I think it's probably a reference to his work in the bakery, but Bloom's first comment here, because this is in Bloom's mind, all very fine to jeer at it now in cold print, which is Ned and Simon making fun of this, you know, bad speech. But it goes down like hot cake, that stuff, right? So it's like, you can make fun of Dawson all you want, but people love that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's kind of patriotic.
They eat it up, yeah.
And it's based about how great Ireland is, so it's appealing to people's, you know, patriotism. And, and then so the hot cake, I think, connects to bakery, and then it kind of comes full circle. Get a grip of them by the stomach.
So he's making money by selling food to people.
Mm-hmm. And also the hot cake, in quotes, of his purple prose.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two ways in which he's getting by the stomach. You know, he's made a small fortune off it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because he has that small fortune, now he's that enables him to have the platform to spread his bad prose, right? He gets to make speeches like that and have them printed in the paper because he's rich, not because he's so much a great writer.
Yeah, that doesn't happen today, though.
No, it never happens at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Guardian.
That's not fair. You can get the New York Times in there as well. If you work for the New York Times, we will take plugs, though. So,
anyway. Also that the Guardian.
Yeah, please.
We'll edit this out.
We are hypocrites.
We can be bought.
We will edit this out for a price. Okay.
All the hot cakes we can eat.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else?
So the little sham squire line, which I know is the theme of this.
Yeah.
Which I think he takes it as a friendly insult, I assume, because if he called somebody this knowing what the sham squire was, I think it would be taken really seriously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so they're saying drinks. No drinks served before mass. So that's uncivilized, but all style rules.
Yeah, he's joking though, as we'll come to see.
Ah, good, good. Yeah. So they're all like, I think this is like lunchtime.
Someone's gonna tell me. I believe Aeolus is around noon.
Okay, close.
Because
enough.
I know Laestrygonians is at 1 o'clock because Bloom gets a late lunch.
Liquid lunch.
Sorry. Liquid lunch. Yeah, it's a bunch of journalists going for a liquid lunch. So, which again never happens in real life.
It doesn't happen anymore. They all stopped doing it. Yeah. Okay. That's good. Yeah. Sounds nice.
Yeah. No, sham squire is used playfully.
Mm-hmm.
And then he calls Professor McHugh a bloody old pedagogue. So, you know, you old so-and-so.
You call somebody a pedagogue today, they'll chase you out of town.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. So who is this? We keep saying he. Who is this?
The Professor McHugh. So we have the inner door was open and a scarlet beaked face thrust itself in the sham. This person is called the sham squire. So it's the editor.
Yeah,
right?
The editor.
So the editor is the sham, has been called the sham squire.
And what is the editor's name?
I forget.
It's in the last line.
Oh, Miles.
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 Miles Crawford.
Yeah.
And we'll mostly call him Crawford, but he's referred to as Miles. Miles Crawford.
Okay.
So what do you think of Miles Crawford so far, just based on the description of him here?
He sounds like he's able to take a friendly ribbing. So far. They all seem like they're having a good time of it.
The inner door was opened violently.
Violently.
And a scarlet beaked face crested by a comb of feathery hair thrust itself in.
Yeah.
The bold blue eyes stared about them and a harsh voice asked, "What is it?"
Yeah. I would interpret that as gruff, but I don't sense like real anger or rage there. It's like, you know, I worked in a print shop in West Dundrow and you'd have that kind of banter back and forward. So until I know otherwise, I'm still filing him under. He's probably okay. Mm-hmm. He's just like used to the loud machines and he's like probably up to his eyeballs.
What do you think he thinks of Mr. Bloom?
Might be a little suspicious about him because Bloom's not a full timer in the office, right? Like he's the ad man coming in, or
he's an ad canvasser.
Yeah. So
but they're colleagues.
Hard to read. Like he's a colleague, but he might just like he's not Bloom wouldn't maybe be in the inner circle at this point.
We'll see. The editor's blue eyes roved towards Mr. Bloom's face, shadowed by a smile.
Okay, so he likes to see him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to talk about three things. We're going to talk about Mr. Weatherup, Mr. Crawford and the Sham Squire. And that's going to be the rest of our episode because there's a lot of information here. So let's start with Weatherup because that's the simplest. So who is Weatherup? That is a question. The Joyce Project's website, which is joyceproject.com, very good online annotation of Ulysses. At one point on their site says that Weatherup is so mysterious that he's on par with Macintosh as far as Ulysses mysteries go.
Okay.
And we don't really know much about him. We see, you know, Doughy Dawn as his fancy life. And Weatherup always said that, get a grip of them by the stomach. So I'm guessing that get a grip of them by the stomach is Weatherup's little aphorism. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything else about Weatherup. He's mentioned once more by Bloom in Eumaeus, which is the 16th episode, the anti-penultimate episode. Mm-hmm. And he's mentioned in a similar way of some little witticism or, you know, little bit of wisdom. He's also mentioned briefly in Circe. There are even some folks who think that Macintosh and Weatherup are one and the same. You can see either our blog post or podcast episode about Macintosh for more info there. I don't think they're the same. John Simpson on the excellent James Joyce online notes, jjon.com. You can find his article on this there or in the further reading section of the show notes of this, which are available at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
He did a little searching and he found the real Weatherup because so many of these names are from people that either Joyce knew or his father knew. William Weatherup, which is spelled with an A, W-E-A-T-H-E-R-U-P, was a real person who worked alongside Joyce's father in the office of the Collector General of Rates in Dublin, where Mr. Weatherup worked for many years. Reading the biography of Mr. Weatherup on the site, he's kind of a normal guy. Like, he started poor. He, you know, was successful in his life. He had money problems that plagued him throughout his life, but he seemed well respected when he retired from the Collector General of Rates office. Yeah, he's just kind of a guy. And my guess, this is me now saying this, is that he's someone that John Joyce liked. He would have been older than Joyce's father, and that he just had all these great little turns of phrase, and so they got repeated in the Joyce home. And James Joyce remembered his father repeating these, and so he sprinkled a couple in. Mm-hmm. That part is my theory. Yeah, it just adds a little bit of color. There are many other examples of people and sayings peppered throughout this novel that would originate with John Joyce. I think notably the description of the Goulding cousins. Mm-hmm. So that's my guess. I don't think there's anything that exciting about Weatherup, but you know, when you see a puzzle, you want to solve it. Were you intrigued by Weatherup?
Just a name to me.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt. So that's, but it's interesting that he gets a headline. Mm-hmm. You know, he's enough to get a headline, but there's not much else to say about him. So let's talk about someone who's a little more interesting, which is Miles Crawford. He is the editor of the Evening Telegraph, which is the newspaper office that our characters are currently in. So we learned a few episodes back that a lot of Aeolus is based on a 1909 visit that Joyce made to the office of the same newspaper when he was visiting Dublin. And at that time, he became acquainted with its then editor, Patrick Mead. This is where our journey begins, I guess. So do you know who Crawford's Homeric parallel would be? The Lord of the Winds, okay. Aeolus. Oh, yeah. Right. So Patrick Mead would have been the real Lord of the Windbags, and Crawford is his counterpart in Ulysses. In fairness to Mead, he was an extremely accomplished political journalist. He reported on the House of Commons, Home Rule, and the Land War in the late 19th century. So definitely earned his editorship. According to Joyce biographer Richard Ellman, however, Crawford is a composite character of Patrick Mead and also of this other guy named Morris Cosgrave, who was the editor of the Telegraph in 1904. He would have been the real counterpart in 1904. By 1909, when Joyce was there, it was Patrick Mead. Cosgrave lent mainly his initials, MC, to Miles Crawford and his position as editor. But Mead really lent his personality. Mm. So when Joyce met him, Mead was around 50 years of age, stout of body, and fond of drink. which, you know, that fits our Miles Crawford pretty well, even in this first introductory section. Miles Crawford comes off maybe a bit self-involved and petty when dealing with Bloom, as you'll come to see, Dermot, because you haven't read some of this stuff. Meade is really remembered for his open-handed nature. Despite this, Meade could have a short temper as well, which we'll also see in Miles Crawford as we go forward. Although this is sort of inflated in his portrayal in Ulysses, which a lot of that is to match the Homeric parallel. Mm-hmm. Because if you remember the Odyssey, Odysseus goes to Aeolus. He gets the bag of the winds, you know, to help him on his journey back to Ithaca. They're in sight of land. His sailors open it and it blows them back. And Aeolus is not as amenable to them the second time around.
Right.
And so that's a pattern we'll see in Crawford in this. Mm-hmm. We just haven't seen it yet because we're only just introduced to him now. Interestingly, Meade was not a profane man, unlike Crawford. So, who later tells Bloom that he can kiss his royal Irish arse. Elman says that this line in particular is a quote from a journalist named John Wise Power rather than Meade. But again, Joyce wanted to get that in there for some realistic color. Meade is also known for his red hair, red face, and the flower he wore in his buttonhole. So in Aeolus, Crawford is described here as having a scarlet-beaked face crested by a comb of feathery hair. So he shares Meade's complexion. What might give someone such a red face?
Well, booze.
Yeah. Okay. And in his jaunty straw hat that we'll see Crawford put on later, he's also a snappy dresser, just like Patrick Meade. It's described as his hat aureoling his scarlet face, so like the halo you'd see in a religious painting. Mm-hmm. He has a little straw hat. Mm. Crawford's red face stands out in particular because red is the correspondent color in Aeolus. I've always assumed that's because the newspaper is black and white and red all over. Feel free to laugh at any time. Crawford, interestingly, is often given or sort of described with bird-like attributes. His beak, his feathery hair.
Yep.
Yeah, scarlet-beaked face, comb of feathery hair. And then in the next headline section, he actually crows. So, All right. Our mascot has appeared. If you're watching this on video, you will notice a small cantankerous cat who doesn't like podcasts. All right. So a bird-like man should stand out, mm-hmm. you know, especially if you're Stephen Dedalus, whose namesake is the hawk-like man, mm-hmm. Dedalus. And especially as Stephen has said, he is here to read the signature of all things inside the newspaper office. In his 1930 book, Ulysses, A Study, Stuart Gilbert wrote, quote, "There is a touch of the bird god Thoth in Aeolus Crawford, as there is a touch of literature in journalism." Mm-hmm. So what do you know about Thoth?
Egyptian version of Hermes.
Mm-hmm.
The winged messenger. And he's got like an Egyptian symbolism. He has the beak. And,
yep. I have a picture of him here.
Would be associated with hermetic magic as well. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What does he look like?
Like a man with a bird head. Big bird mm-hmm. head. Yeah. Book of Thoth was Crowley's magical text that he wrote.
All right. So you're right. Thoth was an Egyptian god. He was the god of
magic.
Writing? Yeah.
Well, same thing, actually. Spells, mm-hmm. spelling, mm-hmm. grammar, grimoire.
Mm-hmm. He's often associated with scribes and libraries, mm-hmm. so a fitting deity for a newspaper editor.
Yeah.
Stephen, who will come into our episode in a few pages, is cognitive of Thoth figures, even later remarking in the 9th episode, Scylla and Charybdis, about Thoth, god of libraries, a bird god, moony-crowned. And I believe Thoth is also mentioned in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
So you just call him out specifically in the text.
He mentions Thoth. He doesn't call Crawford that, but Gilbert is Gilbert is interesting because he likes to talk about Egyptian symbolism. Mm-hmm. He's sort of unusual in that way. People like to talk about the Greeks a lot, but Gilbert is into the Egyptians, which Gilbert talks a lot more about theosophy and early 20th century spiritualism ideas,
mm-hmm.
More so too. In addition to his bird-like face, Miles Crawford sports a Mooney crown in the form of that jaunty straw hat. All right. Gilbert wrote that Thoth is a mediator between literature and the birds of augury. What's augury?
Oh, when you predict the future by bird patterns in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah. Which Stephen described in Proteus, his augur's rod, which is his ash plant.
Which kind of gets us back to the magical stuff.
Yeah. When Stephen meets with Thoth Aeolus Crawford, he receives an augur's message about how his future could look, because journalism was a logical career for a young man looking to make a living from writing. And later in Aeolus, Crawford actually courts Stephen as a potential writer for the Freeman's Journal. He says to Stephen, quote, "I want you to write something for me," he said, "something with a bite in it. You can do it. I see it in your face." So the journalists he meets here in general are sort of financially troubled and alcohol plagued. Mm-hmm. So in awe of their past glories, but quite stagnant in their presence, succumbing to the GPI or general paralysis of the insane that has gripped Dublin as a whole, perhaps even Ireland as a whole. So the augury Stephen receives from these particular birds doesn't bode well. It doesn't seem positive for someone with his talent and potential. So as Stephen starts to think about his future, this definitely plays into it. If you stay here, you're going to be Miles Crawford. You're going to be J.J. O'Molloy and these other guys, some of whom had great potential and squandered it all. All right, so I promised a historical bastard, and here he is. Let's talk about the Sham Squire, an exchange that we already talked about between McHugh and Crawford, but I'll read it again here just so it's fresh in our mind. "And here comes the Sham Squire himself," Professor McHugh said grandly. "Get out of that, you bloody old pedagogue." That's always how I imagined him saying it, the editor said in recognition. And thus begins the story of one of Ireland's most prolific grifters, Francis Higgins.
Boo.
Now, I have a period, I'm guessing, etching of Francis Higgins. Mm-hmm. And I would like you to describe it.
That thing is his Tinder profile. He's not getting any matches. He looks porcine, I think the word.
Porcine?
Porcine, yeah. No one likes this man.
He's got a powdered wig. He's got nice pouty lips.
Yeah. I noticed too the Latin fiat justitia, which is half of fiat justitia ruat caelum, which is let justice be done though the heavens fall.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming somebody is saying let's hang this bastard.
Mm-hmm. Down below it says Belphegor or the devil turned esquire. Mm-hmm. So behind him, he was the editor of the Freeman's Journal as well. Mm-hmm. And it has a newspaper behind him. It says Infernal Journal.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think the artist held a favorable opinion of Mr. Higgins?
It's practically a wanted poster.
Yeah. And he is portrayed rather unflatteringly. And I noticed there is a rope tied in the back, which I would guess.
It's a gallows. It says gallows behind him.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's like.
Oh, yeah. He's got this little thing here that I thought was maybe a tie, but you could see it's the same kind of rope. So.
Yeah, but the rope is hanging from a gallows. So this is the gallows is ready. It's we're going to hang him from the middle of it. Absolutely.
"Yet do I remember the time past. I muse upon my works. Yea, I exercise myself in the works of wickedness." And that is from Psalms. That's at the very bottom there. So yeah, I don't think they like him.
No.
Okay. So who's Francis Higgins? Though he was born into poverty, Higgins' influence would alter the course of Irish history before the end of the century. And that would be the 18th century in which he was born. As a young man, he used his finely honed skills as a forger to weasel his way into high society. He cooked up papers showing that he was a gentleman in possession of an estate in County Down worth a whopping £3,000 per annum. Higgins' work was so convincing that he persuaded a family of good reputation to allow him to marry their daughter. It was discovered soon after their nuptials that Higgins owned no estate whatsoever and was worth a whopping £0 per annum.
"I believe you find I do now own an estate, that one belonging to your daughter."
Well, I as it turned out, a judge did not agree with that, and he ended up spending a few weeks in jail for his deceit, while his victims all died within the year. The entire family died within a year after this.
What? Yeah. The hell.
Yeah. I don't know that Higgins was involved in their deaths, but I think the deceit, especially for the daughter, was extremely intense. Major social humiliation, anger, stress, you know, it got the better of him.
Probably had an arsenic to her pudding, yeah.
Yeah. There's an article in the further reading section on the website entitled The Sham Squire from the Dublin Historical Record in 1972 that is where most of this information comes from. And I'd say it's really worth your time if you'd like to know more about this guy. Far worse for Higgins, though. The judge who oversaw his case coined the nickname Sham Squire. And you see up here, devil turned Esquire.
Yeah.
That's where the squire comes from.
That would stick.
Is he's pretending it being a member of the gentry when he's not. Mm. A nickname that would plague him until the end of his days. Mm. Yeah. Everyone knew he was a fake. But he got away with it anyway. Throughout his life, he took up various money-making schemes following his release from prison. I would say nowadays we would call Higgins a serial entrepreneur.
Yes.
Which always means scammer. If you see someone referring to themselves as a serial entrepreneur, they are a scammer.
He would have a Squire coin.
He would have Squire coin. He would love Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And
I've minted an NFT.
He'd love the internet. Yeah.
Yeah, he would. Yeah. Oh, he would be on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Though he was reputedly semi-literate, Higgins knew that commanding the written word won him even greater wealth, influence, and entry into Dublin's high society. Mm-hmm. So, which he, you know, wielded with great effect. So, Higgins, though he didn't really, I think, have many skills outside of scamming. I suppose it could be argued that scamming is a skill in and of itself. Crime as a full-time job. Mm-hmm. He used the connections that he made to gain the editorship of the Freeman's Journal. So you're making a face. What
this
are you
kind
thinking?
Of stuff doesn't happen today anymore at all. People don't fake their way into editorships of major newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
What a terrible time this must have been.
So prior to Higgins' tenure as editor, the Freeman's Journal had been staunchly opposed to British rule in Ireland. Higgins, however, put an end to that, currying the favor of the pro-British establishment by slanting the paper's coverage in their favor. So during this time, too, he owned another lucrative skill set, which is sharing secrets with the government in Dublin Castle.
Hmm.
This would have been in the 1780s, 1790s. What was going on in Ireland in those decades?
1798 was there a big rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much more violent than 1916.
Mm.
I would think, yeah, no, mm-hmm. probably didn't blow up half of Dublin, but in terms of the body count, like full-blown battles with mm-hmm. major head counts on each side.
Yeah,
victories for the Irish side too, but the British ultimately, of course, squashed them.
Mm-hmm.
My family would have been on several branches, like from Arklow, and another part of the family from Enniscorthy near Vinegar Hill, which mm-hmm. two of the most infamous battles would have been fought.
Mm-hmm.
And the Battle of Arklow, I think, was where the forces were finally more or less their last big stand. Pretty rough, must have been savage. And they would have pikes. They initially had success with pikes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the British, of course, adapted.
Yeah.
And was like, okay, we figured out how to beat these pike-wielding bastards. And then that was it.
Yeah, there are sort of two phases of the 1798 rebellion. There was the upper-class phase and then the rabble phase.
Yeah.
The rabble phase, which we could say the working class or agrarian revolts.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been in Wicklow and Wexford, which is your place of birth. And then there was the upper class, the Tonier Rebellion among Dublin elites. So,
yeah, like the Fitzgeralds.
Yeah. Kind. We'll talk about both of them in the course of Aeolus. Today we're going to talk about the Fitzgeralds and whatnot.
Mm.
And this all led up in, I believe it was in 1800 was the Act of Union. Which it would be at that time that Ireland was subsumed into the United Kingdom.
Right.
They lost their parliament. In Dublin, it was moved to Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
The 1780s and 90s were quite a tumultuous era in history. If these events had gone another way, Ireland would be quite a different country now. And Francis Higgins played his part in all of this because, yeah, I'd say he was really at the center of this. He had a lot of, a whisper network with Dublin Castle, and he was printing the party line through the Freeman's Journal, which sort of became an organ of the pro-British establishment, like I said. I don't know what he felt one way or another. I think he just went where the money was because money is what he wanted. He came from a poor background. And sometimes when you don't have money when you're young, that becomes a huge motivating force for the rest of your life. And if you sometimes to the point where you're willing to just do evil for it.
Yep.
Yeah, so this is what the sham squire did. It was a tumultuous era overall. This is the era when, of the American Revolution and the French Revolution. The Americans in particular had recently fought and won a revolution against the British. The French had overthrown their monarch in a bloody revolution. And I think, we're no friends of the British either. So, there was some concern in London, I would say, about what was going on in Ireland then. A bit of a powder keg. I have to say, too, if I want to pick a fictional character that Higgins reminds me of, it's the guy in Game of Thrones, Varys, with all of his little spiders and little birds and things, where he's sort of this nobody that worked his way into high circles just by having information, the power of information. That's why I think he would have loved the internet. The Catholic population of Ireland during this time had obtained some rights with the loosening of the penal laws. Now, that sounds like a funny name, the penal laws, but it wasn't funny at all.
Nope.
What were the penal laws?
A bunch of very harsh punitive laws against Catholic Irish people. Weren't allowed to have an education, be literate, vote, own property, or own a horse. I believe owning a horse was banned as well. For remember, couldn't practice Catholicism. So, they were the people had countermeasures to that, but they were very much under the thumb.
Even though these laws had loosened up, Catholics were still very much second-class citizens in their own country. Following these other revolutions, like I mentioned, some factions of the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland also saw an opportunity in greater distance from the crown. And I think the various rebels definitely get held up as national heroes, but I think it's always worth mentioning, and I think it's true in the, I'm an American speaking about Ireland, but this is true of American revolutionaries as well, is they, many of them were wealthy, upper class, and the reason they wanted independence from Britain was not so much for these high ideals we like to talk about, but because they would have greater financial opportunities, shall we say. In this atmosphere, the non-sectarian United Irishmen formed. They hoped to build an alliance with France and overthrow British rule in Ireland. This is where your Fitzgerald and your Wolfe Tone will come into play. The United Irishmen succeeded in building a French invasion force, accompanied by the United Irishman himself, namesake to many things in Ireland, Theobald Wolfe Tone. Who is Wolfe Tone?
He was one of the Anglo ascendancy rebels who wanted independence. And when he was finally captured, tried to commit suicide to avoid the noose by cutting his own throat. The doctor stitched him up and said, if you turn your neck, I won't be able to save you again. And he said, I'll be forever in your debt. And he turned his neck and bled out to cheat the hangman. So cut from very tough cloth.
So ultimately tragic end, but
also the namesake of the famous band, the Wolfe Tones.
The Wolfe Tones, yes.
It's a great name too. Wolfe Tone is a great name. You can make it up.
They don't name their kids Theobald anymore. If you had a son, would you call him Theobald?
No.
We know his name. We know he's famous. We know he's beloved. We know he had a tragic, poetic death escaping the noose. But what led him to that? Do you know what he actually did?
Not the particulars, no.
A lot of the United Irishmen's plan was, and this is going to be very back of the envelope, this is not a deep dive by any stretch, they reached out to the French. Yeah, at this time, the French had just succeeded in their revolution. The Bourbon were kings were no more, no more Louis, and they were not fans of monarchy generally, these French revolutionaries, it might surprise you to learn. So the United Irishmen struck a deal with them. They said, send us some ships, we'll invade Ireland from the west. It'll take the British too long to get to us from Dublin. We'll liberate Ireland from the British, All was going according to plan. Wolfe Tone led this fleet, but as these things happen, their hopes were destroyed when a storm destroyed their ships off the west coast of Ireland. They still landed with a small force, but it wasn't enough. And that's the end of Wolfe Tone. He died a hero and a patriot. Lots of stuff is named after him. You can see statues of him in Dublin and further afield, but ultimately unsuccessful. So their revolution attempt was a two-pronged force, though. One was meant to be Wolfe Tone coming from the west. The terrestrial United Irishmen had planned to launch their own uprising in Dublin in 1798 as well. So the idea would be Wolfe Tone would bring people up from one direction, and then it was Lord Edward Fitzgerald in Dublin. All of his guys would rise up at the same time, and they'd catch the British from two sides. So things didn't go well for Wolfe Tone, but they still had the guys in Dublin. But on the eve of their insurrection, their leadership was all suddenly arrested. Doors kicked in, people killed, people grabbed. No one knew what happened, because they thought they were working in secret. The leader of this force, Lord Edward Fitzgerald, he was one of the most prominent leaders of the United Irishmen, escaped capture and went into hiding. A reward of £1,000 was offered for anyone who knew of Fitzgerald's whereabouts. In the end, he was found. Authorities closed in. Fitzgerald tried to escape again, but this time died of wounds incurred during his arrest. He is now interred in St. Werburgh's Church in Dublin, which Leopold Bloom recalls in Hades. That's the one with this famous organ that he's imagined is played by corpse gas.
Okay.
Yeah. How did they find Fitzgerald? People knew it must have been an informant. Someone went for that £1,000 reward, and that's was his undoing, an informant. Someone told his location, and the police were able to find him and kill him.
Right.
And that was the end of the United Irishmen's attempts at revolution in 1798.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, there was a secondary revolution in Wexford and Wicklow. We'll talk about that in our next episode. So we'll put a pin in that for now. And I have pictures here of St. Werburgh's Church. If I'm saying that wrong, please tell me.
I think it's Werburgh.
I don't know how it's pronounced, but what do you think of this church here?
It looks very bland, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It's not architecturally interesting at all. It's
just... Yeah.
Sort of got a neoclassical kind of look to it. And Palladian.
Across from it is a pub called the Lord Edward. So if you're in that part of Dublin, now you know why if you didn't already. So the mystery of Fitzgerald's informant endured well into the mid-19th century. The informant is never caught. And I would say, too, I think, and it's because of... There are many rebellions in Irish history. Some of them are undone by informants. There's an enormous taboo in Irish culture against informants. It's my understanding that, you know, especially in the 19th century, if you were found to have talked to police, like that was the end of you.
Oh, the
quite literally.
The provisional movement was the same in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And very recently, 10 years ago, the steak knife story broke. And Steak Knife was the name given to a senior IRA operative who was an informant for the British. And when it emerged, like, people were shocked because he was like top tier. He wasn't like mid-level. Like, he was apparently very high. And then the people started wondering, like, who else was compromised? If he was compromised, people, then you become paranoid. You start wondering, like, is Martin McGuinness one? You know, I've read people like asking, like, you know, just how many of these people were compromised or turned, because you could also be turned through bribery or through blackmail.
Yep.
And the number of ways they can do it. But I think it couldn't have been too deep, or I don't think they would have, IRA couldn't have pulled off the spectaculars they were doing in the 1990s, like the Manchester bomb or Canary Wharf. They clearly had some sort of like containment that was able to get stuff done. But yeah, like it's be terrifying if you're running a paramilitary or a guerrilla movement to always wonder like who is. But like anybody who was suspected was either kneecapped or shot. Like you'd terrible.
And we'll see too in this chapter episode of Ulysses, we'll get into the history of the Invincibles and the Phoenix Park murders as well, who were eventually undone as well by an informant. Or in that time, it was not so much a police informant, it was that one of their guys turned on him and ratted them all out. So the mystery of Sir Edward Fitzgerald's informant, though, like I said, it lasted for decades. Nobody ever came forward. They never found out who did it until the middle of the 19th century. Around that time, an antiquarian bookseller acquired a big bundle of documents from Dublin Castle. And most of them were uninteresting, just like procedural stuff. But luckily for us, this bookseller was very meticulous, because this easily could have gotten thrown out. Like, so, oh, these are all ledgers. I'll just chuck it out. But he that was not this guy. Tucked in these stacks of boring documents was a ledger called Secret Service Money Expenditure. And it contained the entry June 20th, 1798, FH discovery of LEF, 1,000 pounds.
Oh, God.
So what do you see in there?
Lord Edward Fitzgerald.
LEF.
That's the reward. And who were the initials of the...
FH.
FH?
FH.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think FH
meant? Francis Higgins.
Yes. FH must surely be Francis Higgins, LEF, Lord Edward Fitzgerald. The documents made clear that FH didn't discover LEF's location on his own. He used his whisper network of spies that he had cultivated through the Freeman's Journal to discover Fitzgerald's hiding spot and then pass the information on to the authorities. Maybe you're not convinced by these initials. FH can stand for a lot of things. So if that's not strong enough proof for you, no worry. In another book entitled The Memoirs and Correspondence of Marquess Cornwallis, Higgins is also named as the informer who brought down the rebels. A quote from this book.
Francis Higgins, proprietor of the Freeman's Journal, was the person who procured for me all the intelligence respecting Lord Edward Fitzgerald and got £300 to set him, and has given me much information.
Yeah.
So only 300 there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But in their accounting, he got his full 1,000. So maybe, actually, I have a further note about this. So Cornwallis, if you don't know who he was the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in 1798. And the sham squire received a pension of £300 per annum for his efforts. So I think that's the 300.
Is this the same Cornwallis who was involved in the American Revolutionary War?
I believe so. I'm not sure, though. But it would have been the right time period.
Mm. Yeah. So. Yeah, he'd have to be relative if he's not. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. By this point, Francis Higgins was gone. But this resurfaced then in the mid-19th century about this guy who had sold out this, you know, Irish hero for money. Just money. And so his name became synonymous with treachery all the way down until 1904. And he was an editor. So Miles Crawford isn't the editor of the whole Freeman's Journal. He's the editor of one of its subsidiary papers, the Evening Telegraph. Mm. But when Professor McHugh goes, oh, it's the sham squire. Definitely. Yeah, that's the joke.
Right.
It's a really long explanation to that joke. Yeah, I mean, McHugh isn't exactly accusing him of any like high crimes or misdemeanors. It's just like, it's just banter. He calls Crawford the name of the most ignominious person to hold the position of editor in Freeman's Journal history. Mm-hmm. Universally hated. I don't know if the average person on the street would know the name Sham Squire now, but they did 100 years ago, 100 plus years ago. Yeah, however, I would say like a pebble dropped in a pond, this comment ripples out over the next few headline sections, turning up memories of 1798 that linger just beneath the surface of Dublin's consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1904 Dublin, this would be a similar historical distance as we are now from like World War I.
Mm-hmm.
It's long enough ago that really no one alive would remember it firsthand,
mm-hmm.
but it's just on the edge of living memory, I'd say.
Yeah.
So... and definitely in the political climate of 1904, so you're still 12 years out from 1916, but there's a pretty strong political nationalist movement at that time. There's a lot of talk about certainly home rule, though home rule has kind of died with Parnell in some ways. It eventually passed it, but really at this time is the rise of Arthur Griffith and Sinn Féin and full independence.
Said it before, the Home Rule Act passing in 1914, like a month or two before the war breaks out, is just staggering.
Yeah.
It's just shocking. You think like they spent like the best part of 60, 70 years trying to get that bloody thing passed. And just the war and the rising just washes it all away.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, within 20 years, Ireland would be an independent state. So,
Sort of.
Enough.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
No, it's good.
So what do you think would have happened if the sham squire had not turned in Fitzgerald?
No, they'd still have been beaten. Look, the fatal mistake all the enemies of Britain make is they fail to realize what the British realize, which is that if you want to screw Britain, you have to take Ireland. Ireland has to be taken away from them. They lose the territorial waters. You have a hostile power with seaports walling them in on their western seaboard. And every attempt any other country made to support Irish independence was half-arsed. It's commit to it. Mm-hmm. Like if I've learned one thing about watching Age of Empires computer game videos on YouTube on by a Twitch streamer, you have to commit.
Mm-hmm.
No half measures. Mm-hmm. No half measures. Complete and total commitment. If France wants to help Ireland, commit. Send mm-hmm. your entire freaking navy.
So French helped the Americans as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, send yeah. wave after wave after wave. We have a
bunch of stuff called
wave.
Lafayette.
Yeah, yeah. Your armada sank. You send another one. And it's like, oh, well, that didn't work. We won't do it again. And then you wonder why Britain rules the waves and has a bigger empire than you. It's because you didn't commit to stopping yep. them from having complete dominance of the North Atlantic. And the Germans mm-hmm. failed, the French failed, the Spanish failed. The Russians, when they had a communist empire, failed. The Chinese will fail. None of them understand it. The British understand it. It drives them mad. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Well, I would say, though, the a revolution of this scale where they get close is a once-in-a-generation thing because mm-hmm. it's not, I think it's, I can't remember what year it was Robert Emmet's attempted rebellion that just fizzled, mm-hmm. just fizzled hardcore, which we've talked about in our Hades episodes. But it was sort of too soon, like too many important people died. Fitzgerald and Wolfe Tone were major losses.
Mm-hmm.
As leaders, hundreds of people, if not thousands, died in Vinegar Hill and yeah. New Ross and, you know, these other places and in Wexford were really just bloody, like bloody, bloody battles. Mm-hmm. You know, there really is a divide in 1798 between the Gentile Rebellion and the Rabble Rebellion. And the second one, they actually fought battles and they won battles too, mm-hmm. armed with pikes against... Yeah. The British Army. But I think you can do that once. So you get one shot.
Yeah.
That's Robert Emmet's mistake. You know, another beloved fallen patriot. But it's sort of too soon. You know, they try another one in the 1860s. It fizzles. Yeah. And then, you know, the next big one's 1916.
It seems to be about a 50 to 100 year cycle of building up a charge of yeah. young men. And,
yeah.
And yeah, new technology. And,
it's not something you can do lightly.
No.
You know.
No. Like when the provisional movement kicked off around 1970, that was almost 50 years after 1920. And, you know, they were, mm-hmm. but you bottle people up like a powder keg. You can only do that for so long until mm-hmm. they explode. And like all the Irish myth cycles were from, you know, like the really violent ones are all Ulster men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no surprise that, you know, they would be the ones to be the most resilient because the IRA were demonized in Irish media, whatever you think about them. But phenomenal, like, commitment to that cause to fight like that from 1970 through to 1997 or 98 is almost 30 mm-hmm. years of the worst kind of life. Like, and to like stretch that kind of torture out over 3 decades, I've read a person writing about they're like almost superhuman. It's like
mm-hmm.
the you look at the sacrifices that had to be made. And again, I'm not making any judgments for or against. It's just to live that kind of life, and you look at people who consider themselves political activists now, they have mm-hmm. no idea of that kind of like pain endurance. And the kind of anger that has to fuel that
mm-hmm.
is astonishing. And to fuel that for 3 decades and not to have it burn out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also unusual.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it also, I think, shows the desperation there, because if you fight like that for that long, you feel like you have nothing left. Nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose. You might as well get the hunger strike or starve them to death mm-hmm. because they wouldn't wear a prison uniform.
Yeah. And 1798, by the time the fighting starts in Wexford, it's already a lost cause. Mm. Like, they, you know, they had some early victories, but they kept fighting. Like,
it's going to keep, it was clearly it was coming in waves, and it was sooner or later one of them was going to get the ingredients right. Like, 1916 mm-hmm. was a fluke. Like the fact
and
that.
And also
worked,
not immediately successful either.
Yeah. I mean, the British. They made the fatal mistake of executing the leaders. If they just sentenced mm-hmm. them to life and thrown away the key, they probably mm-hmm. could have pulled it off and gotten away with like keeping Ireland in tow for another few decades. But like, let's just make martyrs of them. You know, how fucking stupid are you? How stupid are you?
And I think there's something about a man killed fighting for Ireland by the British specifically that holds a reverence in the, you know, even... Now, I think in people's minds, and certainly in 1904, as we'll see when we talk about subsequent passages, that Miles Crawford certainly, and the other guys as well, like, holds a certain magic for them.
Yeah.
You know, it stirs a patriotic spirit within them.
Yeah. So. Like, I think if you were looking for any kind of analog to the Irish and said the Middle East with the Shia Muslims, same kind of culture of, like, absolute elevation to martyrdom and... a group of people that are used to being on the lower end of things, who are always like playing second fiddle or fighting for their like existence as a separate culture. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Iranians named Bobby the street next to the British embassy Bobby Sands Street. So every time the British have to write their address, they have to write down Bobby Sands.
All right. Well, do you think that's a good place to call it for this week?
I guess so. Don't be an informant.
Yeah, no, don't. Yeah. Snitches get stitches.
If he'd been caught, poof.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, the sham squire, he had it all locked up. Like, I'm sure, knew everything about everybody. Like, there's a lot more to be said about him. This is sort of the short version here. Go read that article. It's linked in my show notes if you'd like to have a more detailed story of his life. Yeah, no, he knew everybody's business, and he got a nice little took a change off of it. £300 was
a fortune,
enough to be comfortable.
If he got the full 1,000, then he was doing really well.
I would guess he knew the secrets of everyone at Dublin Castle. All the important merchants, everybody.
Who was shagging who? And,
and who? Which ones were shagging boys and girls?
Game of Thrones. He had the compromise on everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's some tendency to inflate him as well. But I think you don't have to know everything, but you have to know enough. Mm-hmm. And I think he knew more than enough. So, and he was a real scumbag. So let's end there.
Yeah, I hope he's in hell now.
Yes. Okay. We hope he's in hell, and we hope you're not. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.